This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's legislation at the State House that would change how Vermonters pay for education. It would no longer use the property tax to finance school budgets. Instead, it would use the income tax. Under this plan, all homeowners would pay the same percentage of their income to support their schools. The plan would raise tax burdens on the wealthy and reduce them for middle-income people. Senate Finance Chairwoman Ann Cummings is skeptical about the plan because she doesn't think the income tax is a stable source of revenue.
There's a danger to schools. You can't set your, you know, your budget in March and then, whoops, the stock market drops and the money's not there when you go to open the doors. So it's finding a balance with stable. I think we can look at adjusting it. You know, but I'd want to be very cautious. I wouldn't want to make this any more unclear and unstable than it already is.
Is this a bill that lawmakers should strongly consider? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. Lieutenant Governor, great to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks. It's good to be here, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you think are the most important issues for lawmakers to deal with this session? What's at the top of your list? What do you think about this plan of shifting the funding of education from the property tax over to the income tax? And perhaps you have some thoughts about a plan that would provide Vermonters with primary care health care services through a government finance program. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. But give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So right now, roughly 70% of all homeowners in Vermont pay their school taxes based on their income, not the value of their property, through a program known as income sensitivity. And the rates differ from town to town because local spending levels are different. But roughly on average, most people in this program pay between 2.5% and 3% of their income to support education. The program has an eligibility cap of roughly $130,000 a year. You want everybody, all homeowners, to pay based on their income. Why is that?
Well, ultimately, when you look at a graph, which you can't do here on public radio, but when you look at a graph, as you stated, most Vermonters, if they do file the income sensitivity form with their taxes, which not everybody does, but given that it's tax season, I'd like to remind you, if you have a household income of $137,000 or so or less, you do get an adjustment on your property tax bill, and please take advantage of that. That's why the law is there, to help make it so that education is more affordable for Vermonters. But if you're above that number, it actually drops off dramatically to where people making $200 or $400 or $1 million see their payments towards education drop from that 2.5% to 3% down to 2% and 1% and even 0.5%. And as someone who believes that we should be paying for government services based on our ability to pay, not just based on a flat rate, essentially, right now, wealthier Vermonters are not paying the same percentage as everybody else is. And, you know, I respect Chair Cummings on the Committee on Committees, helped put her in that position. And I really respect her thought process there. And that's been one of the big hurdles in going to an income-based system. But just as when the property tax, property values collapse happened in 2008, 2009, these rates can be adjusted up or down to generate the same amount of revenue if the costs to run our schools are the same. And we did that through when we adjusted the property tax rate back then, and we could do that if there was a big up or down in the income scenario as well.
So under your plan, if I understand it correctly, what would happen is wealthy people would pay more than they are right now. So you'd end up with more money. And is the idea to take that money, not spend it, but then lower tax rates for middle income people?
Well, exactly. And actually, unlike Governor Scott's plan with the budget, which was actually going to shift more cost into the education fund and was going to basically require local voters to increase your own taxes by voting it on your municipal side to cover some of the expenses. This is a net zero tax proposal that Senators Pearson and Polina put in that would garner about $40 million more in that wealthier group of folks in that top 30%. And then it would actually, across the board, lower the rate for everybody. And you know, a lot of middle class folks would save $200 to $400 in this tax shift, essentially, which would again shift it to being an equal burden across your income across the state. And as you pointed out, Bob, depending on what your local vote is, that rate's going to be a little higher or a little lower, just as it is today if you spend more on your students per pupil or less.
So for people to understand how this would work, let's say we have two homeowners that live in the same town. One has a household income of $500,000. Let's use that 3% number. Their tax bill would be $15,000. Another person has a household income of $50,000. Again, 3%. Their tax would be $1,500. Quite a difference there. Some people might wonder, is this really fair?
Well, ultimately, if you're basing it on someone's income, that is a direct reflection of their ability to pay. And yes, to most Vermonters, $15,000 is a tremendous amount of money. That's, you know, a half to a third of what a lot of Vermonters take home in a year. But as a percentage of their income, as sort of the pain or the contribution to our society, it would be the same proportionally as that $1,500 is to that $50,000 income household. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at fairness. Right now, a speeding ticket, you know, is a flat rate. You might get a ticket of $200 for a certain speed violation. Well, to someone making $20,000 a year, that $200 is a lot more money than to someone making $200,000 a year. So is that fair? So one can ask the fairness question really back and forth on any ways that we collect revenue for the state. But generally, my values and tends to be the progressive way of thinking is that if you pay based on your income, it's the same proportional pain as either a penalty in the case of a speeding ticket, which we're not actually talking about right now, or as a contribution to make sure our education system is fully funded and viable for all kids across the state.
Let's go to our callers. We've got a number of folks who want to weigh in on this topic, starting with Dan, who's calling from South Newfane. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Hey, I'd like to point out that the Chris Pearson and Anthony Polina's bill, it's shifts to income, but it's not only the income tax. When people talk about, they talk about the drop in income and, you know, that's too volatile. That bill actually has a formula which says at a certain, like if you're at the 137 level, you're going to pay, or above that level, I guess it was, you're going to pay the greater of either what your income would determine you would pay or your property tax bill formula would determine you were going to pay. And at a certain income level down, you would pay the lesser of those two amounts. So if there's a big drop in the income in the state, the property tax formula, which is still there, would kick back in. So it's actually buffering the vagaries of the economic system.
You're right.
By using both property values and income levels to and with a formula right within the bill to make those adjustments. So what I don't understand is when our reps are saying there's no traction for that bill, no citizen I speak to is anything other than enthused about the idea. So why are their politicians not, why are they sort of mischaracterizing it and thinking there's no traction about it? It has me confused.
Well, I appreciate the question, Dan. Nice to hear your voice again. One thing I would say is that in general, in the political arena of Montpelier, it's a bit insulated, granted less insulated than an Albany or a Sacramento where the states are so huge that people can never reach their legislators. But one of the things that I actually campaigned on and am continuing to work on through a newsletter I put out, but also through an open coffee hour every Friday morning or hour and a half from 8:30 to 10. Anybody across the state is welcome to come to the Lieutenant Governor's office. But the goal of these things is to actually get more citizens engaged in the process, to encourage people to call your legislator, to when you bump into them, you know, you don't want to harass them at the grocery store or, you know, at home in the evening hours. But we are very accessible as your elected representatives, and in my case, as Lieutenant Governor, to these conversations. So if Vermonters feel that this is a good idea, then call and talk to your legislator. And sometimes people feel a little bit intimidated to do so because they might feel like they don't know enough of the facts or that they might not be an expert while the legislator may know more about a particular topic. I've really been out there saying your experience is your expertise. And to be perfectly honest, as legislators, we are not experts on everything. We are continually learning, and that's a good thing. But the more constituents reach out, the more momentum an idea like this would get. So I appreciate your question because it really is a call to action, as the election of this new president has been, for people to reengage in the political process, not just when we vote every 2 or 4 years, although in Vermont, of course, also every year for town meeting day, but to actually participate between the elections and talk to your legislators.
Let's also talk to Maurice, who's calling from Montpelier. Hey, Maurice, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
Good.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yep, turn your radio down. Sometimes it's a delay of a few seconds. We can hear you.
Can you hear me now, sir?
Yep.
Okay, well, Maurice, are you there?
Can you hear me?
All right, Maurice, we'll see if we can get you back on. Apparently, there is some technical problem, and we hope to deal with that soon. We also had an email that came in very much on the same subject of Dan's, of someone named Kim who supports this concept very much and wants to know, is there a grassroots way of organizing in support of this legislation?
Well, I don't know yet that there's a specific grassroots group that is organizing behind this, although there are a number of groups looking at fairer taxation in Vermont, whether it's Public Assets Institute, which isn't as much of an advocacy organization as a fact-presenting organization. Rights and Democracy is a group that's across the state working at on economic, environmental, and social injustices throughout the state, and they certainly are a good network to tie into. And as I indicated, you certainly can contact my office and, you know, we can get you onto our e-newsletter that sometimes will put out information about what's happening and ways to get involved. But individually, what I would encourage people across the state, whatever your issue and whatever your passion is, to also establish a relationship with your legislator and let them know. It doesn't mean calling them every day. That starts to be a little bit – can feel like harassment. But ultimately – developing a relationship, presenting your views on issues, that's what our job is as your elected folks, is to listen and hear that.
Let's see if we can get Maurice back on the line. Hey, Maurice, welcome to the program.
Well, let's try it again. Thank you.
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Great. Just two things. What do you do with a $2 million home owned by a trust fund baby that has no income? The other thing, what do you do when you have a millionaire that got a business here in Vermont and lives in New Hampshire or New York and takes his money out of state? So we're not going to tax him his second home as high. We're not going to tax his business as high. We're going after his income, but he's in another state. Just
well,
a thought.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. And actually, we already have that addressed in current policy, and it would continue. Your primary residence is what this tax would apply to. So if it's a business or it's a second home because it is not your primary residence because you've chosen to live outside the state for 6 months or more, then you would still have the property tax rate established on those properties. So that we would not eliminate that revenue source. Everybody's got to pay their fair share. And with respect to the $2 million home and trust fund income, again, actually Dan mentioned this earlier, if the property value is high and you are low income, you certainly get the property adjustment. But if you are a trust funder and you're living off income from a fund, that's still income. And that is appropriately taxed like any other.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Paula in Enosburg Falls. Hey, Paula, welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to change to a different topic, and that's the universal publicly financed primary care bill that is being introduced right now. It's universal primary care for everyone in Vermont. And you haven't discussed it yet, so I would like to ask the Lieutenant Governor how he feels about it. And in particular, I'm really excited about the potential. It has a mental health and opiate addiction services aspect to primary care that would be available to everybody in the state. I think that could be a really boon in dealing with the opiate drug crisis, and I just want to get the Lieutenant Governor's opinion on that.
Paula, thanks very much. A great topic to talk about. This is some legislation that's currently being introduced. It would provide primary care to all Vermonters. How would it be paid for? What kind of services would it cover?
Sure. My understanding is that's House Bill number 248 and Senate Bill number 53. For those who do end up wanting to contact their legislators, pro or con to this idea, it's good to have those numbers. So universal primary care, my understanding is, would be paid for through a payroll tax. I think it's in the 1%, maybe 1.5% range. I'm not exactly sure. And it would then create universal primary coverage, universal primary care for all Vermonters across the state. And there's a lot of reasons to do this. One is that if you have access to primary care without it being a huge cost, for instance, this would have no deductibles, no copays, then you would typically go in when you first get sick and not have issues get to a second or third level, which cost the system more, which ultimately means everybody pays more, whether it's through private insurance or at this point, you know, Health Connect or others. So if we can catch illness earlier, we will save the whole process money. And I think we're all looking for ways to reduce the costs of health care. With respect to access to mental health and the opioid crisis, similarly, if we can get folks in the door earlier on in their addiction, if it's opioids, or earlier on in circumstances where folks have some mental health challenges, often those are more treatable with lower cost remedies. So anytime you can get in early, it's better.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. Under this legislation, everybody in Vermont would have guaranteed primary care. That would be paid for, and there'd be a small payroll tax surcharge to finance it. And then would folks go to private health insurance companies, either on their own or through their employers, and get more coverage, more comprehensive coverage?
Well, I'm not exactly sure of all the details. I'll admit that as we go forward. But, of course, right now we have almost universal health coverage through Health Connect and then also through employer-provided health care. And as we all know right now, health care is very much up in the air. What does the future hold, both particularly out of Washington? Are they going to slowly eviscerate and take apart the health care system? Are they now realizing, as some I think in Congress are, that actually getting rid of the health care plan in Washington will actually hurt their own constituents? So maybe that quick idea of repeal is becoming a little less palatable to them. But we don't know what they're going to do. They did just the other day vote to shrink the open enrollment period from 3 months to 6 weeks. So they may try to essentially destroy the Affordable Care Act through 1,000 cuts. We'll see. So a lot of this is moving parts. But if we can establish universal primary care through this system, then yes, beyond that, it would be a health insurance system, whether it's Affordable Care Act, private insurance, employer. That would be a general model.
Do you think our primary care system can handle this? I mean, there's some parts of the state now where, you know, if you want to get a primary care physician, a lot of people are already booked and it's hard to get access to them. Would this make that problem worse?
Well, and we've seen, you know, you're right. It's a real challenge. In Franklin County, some doctors closed shop about a year ago, I think, at this point. Time flies. It might have been a little longer than that. And that's a real issue and real concern. Fair question. We certainly have to pay our doctors appropriately. And folks think all doctors make a ton of money. Typically, specialists make a lot of money. Primary care doctors, it's not the same as the specialists. And we would have to make sure our reimbursement rates, whether it's through this program, but also from insurance companies. Right now, independent doctors, of which many primary care doctors are, don't get the same reimbursement from insurance companies as hospital-affiliated doctors. And much of the public doesn't know that. But I think if we can figure out a way to say, you know what, when hospitals negotiate a payment plan for their services from the insurance companies, that the independent doctors have to get at least some percentage of that. Right now, it's about 40 to 45%. We can move that number up, then we would have better paid primary care doctors and we would attract more doctors to the state.
Today in the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. When we come back, we're going to be talking about immigration policies, marijuana, and the minimum wage. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Jay in North Powell. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Well, what's on my mind? I'm changing the subject a little bit. I thought, except I had made a comment about what I thought was very unfair, the fines. Unfortunately, within 6 months after the person I was talking to had retired from the House, and that was, I explained, you know, I'm making $300 a week. I get a $300.50 fine. That hurts me. Somebody making $3,000 a week, no problem. But anyhow, what my question was, with your extensive knowledge of organic growing and things, what part will you be playing in agricultural decisions?
Sure. Well, thank you, Jay. I appreciate it. The Lieutenant Governor's office is an interesting office because I don't actually write policy or I'm not integrated into the committee process. In fact, I only vote to break a tie. And I'm not part of the administration and the Agency of Agriculture. But what I do plan to do, and I did talk about this quite a bit last spring, summer, and fall, is continue to work on the broad discussion and helping get more people involved, as we said earlier, around policy from the outside. Ask people to engage with their legislators about agriculture in general. And as you did point out, I happen to be an organic farmer, and I know a fair amount about organic production and actually vegetables and sales and business of farming. One of the things I'm working to do in terms of our rural economy is two things. One, I'm working to convene a group of people with different expertise in the dairy industry in particular about how to find a way to create more stable milk pricing. And obviously, this is an issue that's been going on for decades, but I think more and more farmers are recognizing that the up and down swing is slowly eroding our base of small farms throughout the state. And that also, when we talk about water quality, farmers don't want to pollute the water, which, by the way, they're about 40% of the water pollution issues are from farming. There's still a lot from urban runoff and septic or sewer systems. But the 40% from farming, farmers don't want to be polluting. But when you're not getting paid as much as it costs to produce your product, it's hard to then take some acreage out of production or to use different practices that might cost a little bit more. So until we find a way to make sure farmers are paid stably and well for their work, we're going to continue to have these environmental consequences from farming. I would also say that when I was in the State House as a legislator, we passed Farm to Plate. We passed a number of other bills to really look at what the agricultural economy is in this state and where it's growing and where opportunities are. And we've seen some real growth. And there are a lot more people being trained and interested in growing small farms that are 2 or 3 acres, not dairy at this point, into 5 and 20 acre farms. That's going to employ more people and bring more people to live in the rural areas. The third piece I would say is broadband internet into our rural areas, not only to support farms that are doing value-added products to be able to market those products, but also to allow people who aren't farmers to make a decent living in our rural areas so that they would stay in those rural areas and not necessarily drive 30 or 50 miles to work where they then shop at a grocery store in town. They actually stay and work in their communities. They're more likely to shop at their local farm stands and so forth. So it's a self-fulfilling benefit for the farmers to get a better price for their product. So there's a lot of things to be done. I'm not going to be able to wave a magic wand, but you're right on the money.
Let's look at agriculture as it relates to immigration policies. How do you think the immigration policies of the Trump administration might affect the roughly 1,000 foreign workers who are a very critical part of Vermont's dairy industry?
Well, there's no doubt it's having a profound effect even today. A lot of the workers are now staying hunkered down on the farms, afraid to go out because they might get rounded up. And we just, I think, got another order out of the president. It's not an executive order, but another dictate by the president to deputize more ICE agents and others to round up folks who are not here legally. And I recognize that there's some on the other side that say, well, they should just come through the legal process. Well, in Washington, there have been attempts to reform the immigration policy for quite a long time. There was a bipartisan bill that passed the Senate that would have allowed for more legal migration into this country. And the Republican House, you know, killed it right out of the gates. And so when they say we should do more to have them come in legally, that's a very two-faced comment out of Washington because they're not doing anything to make that possible. And, you know, these folks are hardworking individuals just like anybody else. I just said to one of my employees on the farm, I said, you know, if you could go to Canada and make five times the wages what you're making here on my farm, would you cross the border illegally to go up there and then be able to send money home? He's like, well, yeah, why wouldn't I do that? Well, that's what we're talking about. My employee is not a criminal. My employee is not an evil person. My employee is not interested in undermining our economy or the Canadian economy. He just wants to better his life and his family's life. So when you put it into what would you do if you were in those shoes, you try to get across the border and better your family's life and your own economic life. And that's what these folks are doing. They're very good individual people. And our dairy farmers, as we just said with the last caller, don't make enough to pay people really what it's worth to do the hard work that happens on farms. And so we don't have the workforce here to do it. And it would really undercut our agricultural economy, particularly our dairy industry, if this administration follows through and really does round up and work to deport these folks.
You've got a bill that will probably be on the Senate floor sometime next week that would prohibit state and local law enforcement officials from being deputized by the Trump administration for the purpose of cracking down on immigration issues. Do you support that approach?
I do. I stood with the governor. I really applaud Governor Scott for putting together this cabinet panel and with the Attorney General, T.J. Donovan, working really hard to draft the language and now the Senate and eventually the House committee to really look into this issue. They may even be doing it simultaneously so it can get out of the House more quickly. We are a state that respects individuals for who they are, not for what they are or what their belief in religion is or who they love. And we absolutely want to draw the line that we're not going to put people into boxes based on some stereotype or some physical characteristic, color of their skin. And we are just simply putting that into law so that our law enforcement agents don't end up with information that then becomes that whole sanctuary state or city situation where if we withhold information from the federal government, then the federal government is talking about punishing municipal or states that do that. So if we don't collect the information, then we're not actually withholding anything. And that, you know, it's actually not constitutional for the federal government to force our law enforcement agents to do work on their behalf without also paying for that. And that's where we have some legal jurisdiction to say that's the line we're not going to cross. If you want to round people up, spend federal dollars on your federal agents. We will certainly work with them with respect to crimes and safety in our communities and so forth. But we're not going to collect data that that is unnecessary to collect.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Ken, who's calling from Woodstock. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a marijuana question.
Okay.
I thought the lawmaker's responsibility was to make laws for the general good of the community. I think the marijuana law will be a law for the good of the individual, not the good of society or community. For example, the seatbelt law is good for all citizens. And the New Hampshire motorcycle law is freedom for the individual, not community. Thank you.
All right, Ken, thanks for your phone call.
Ken, I appreciate the call, and it's an interesting frame to put that discussion in. But actually, in my opinion, and that of the majority of Vermonters who actually do support changing our cannabis laws, it's for many, many reasons. One, and I do think this is for the good of the community, right now, the place that people go to get cannabis, and that includes young people, kids in high school and sometimes even younger, is out on the street to a drug dealer. I don't think that's good for the community. I think that's unsafe for our young people, where whatever they buy may be laced with another drug, or if the drug dealer is out of cannabis, they might offer them some other drug for a different high that may be more addictive and more life-altering. So for the good of our community, I think reducing the underground market is a good idea. And having it now eventually through a regulated market would greatly alter that landscape. And that's been proven true in Colorado, where the vast majority of cannabis bought and sold is now in a regulated market and not in an underground market. So you're actually splitting that relationship between particularly young people, but anybody, and a drug dealer. You know, most crime around drugs is around the transaction. So for the good of the community, let's get rid of that type of transaction. So I appreciate the rationale of thinking about the good of community, and I think in many ways that's what we're doing. It happens to have other ancillary benefits. We have a budget that was just presented by the governor a few weeks ago that really was not a real budget. It actually just on straight value didn't have enough money to cover all the promises that were made. And it relied not only, even still, with having short the amount of money it needed, it relied on local voters to vote locally at their town level to increase their own property taxes in order to cover some of the expenses that were put into that budget. So while the governor has said he wouldn't support raising any taxes, he would basically be saying, okay, but I'm going to ask all the Vermonters to vote to raise their taxes on their own. So I think we have some real fundamental economic challenges in this state, and we have a huge underground economy that we could bring above board, and it would both make the community safer by getting rid of these underground sales and purchases. And it would be a revenue source that we could have for opiate treatment, which would then help our community as well, because a lot of the crime around drugs is stealing money to feed a drug addiction. Well, let's have more money for drug treatment. Let's have more money for law enforcement. Let's have more money for education and prevention so that our youth understand that your brains are still developing when you're 20, 22, 25 at the very outside. But in high school, that these drugs really can alter your future even if you don't become addicted. So more money for education. Those are all things that could happen if we change this system to an above board system.
So the House this year is taking a look at a plan that's quite different than the marijuana legalization plan that passed the Senate last year. As you mentioned, the Senate plan set up a state regulatory model based on Colorado retail stores taxing the product. The House approach is more personal possession, right, up to an ounce or two. That's up for debate. You can grow a couple of plants. What about the House approach?
Well, certainly I applaud the House for taking up the discussion this year when last year they really struggled. They didn't have enough time to really look at the details and the issues. They hadn't set the table earlier in the session by looking at the RAND report with the various details and information and facts. It's important to make laws based on facts, which in this day and age out of Washington is we're all thinking Orwellian-wise with what's upside up and upside down. But the bottom line is, they are discussing it in the House. I think it's a real step forward. I think there's been a movement both with the votes that happen in neighboring states, the votes that happen across the country. My own election as lieutenant governor, as an outspoken advocate of this change, that I think that shows the state isn't going to – the voters aren't going to throw you out for having a rational discussion about cannabis. And so they are moving the dial, and they really move the discussion from, you know, bad good to, okay, this exists. What's the best way to regulate it? So I look forward to their moving, legislation forward. Is it complete in my mind? No, but it's a step in the right direction. And, you know, there's a long way to go here. If you can have it, but you don't grow it, where do you get it? Right now, folks will drive to Massachusetts or they'll drive to Maine, which for most of Vermont, either one of those places is within a couple hours. So why would we encourage that activity when instead, we could go beyond that home grow model? But I think it's a step in the right direction.
Let's talk to Dan, who's calling from Plainfield. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Very good.
Good, thank you.
Hey, so I just want to say I'm an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran, so I'm personally excited about the possibility of legalization for personal use and home growing, which I can't take any of the medications that, you know, the VA normally prescribes. They just completely destroy me, make me a walking zombie. So that part of it I'm looking forward to, but I really feel we're missing out on the economic opportunity here. As you said, people are going to go to New Hampshire or Maine or Massachusetts. And so we're giving them tax revenue and bringing it back across the border tax-free.
Well, Dan, I appreciate that. I've been an advocate of changing this law for a number of years, and every year that goes by, I think what you've just stated is true. New Hampshire doesn't have it, just to be clear, but the other two do. And I think you're absolutely right. It's already an economy that's there. People can pay their fair share of taxes. We'd probably have more skier visits and more fall foliage visitors. We're excited about people coming to drink, beers that we brew here in Vermont, and that seems to be okay. So I don't know why it's a different double standard when it comes to cannabis, when alcohol clearly causes more problems than cannabis. I know we're wrapping up here shortly, and I just want to put out there that if people do want to reach out to me, you can go to the Lieutenant Governor website, which is ltgov.vermont.gov. That's ltgov.vermont.gov, to either contact me with follow-up questions if you didn't get through on the airwaves, or to sign up for my e-newsletter, which will talk about some of these issues in further detail over the course of the next few months.
Well, a lot of issues for us to follow here. Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, I really appreciate it, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger about the prospects for the House marijuana bill this session. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The House Judiciary Committee is considering a bill to legalize marijuana that's quite different from a plan that passed the Senate last year. While the Senate plan created a state regulatory structure where marijuana would be sold in retail stores and all products would be taxed, the House approach simply allows individuals to possess up to 2 ounces of marijuana, and folks could also grow several plants. So what's the outlook for this legislation? With us now to look at this bill is Elizabeth Hewitt, who's been covering this issue very closely for VT Digger. Elizabeth, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned, the House this year is taking a very different approach than the one taken by the Senate last year. Why is it doing that? Why have they decided to go in a different direction?
So last year, lawmakers were looking at a model that was very similar to what's out in Colorado, has a regulated market that allows for sale of marijuana through different retail outlets throughout the state. That bill ran into a lot of opposition, especially in the House, with a lot of people saying that's sort of out of scale for Vermont. So when lawmakers came back this year in the House, they decided to look more to the Washington, D.C. model, where where it's legal to have marijuana. It's not legal to sell it. There's no big market like there is in other states. And so they decided to give that a run, thinking that that might be more on the scale of Vermont. The other key component that was not in the bill last year was home grow. This bill would allow Vermonters, adults, to grow small amounts of plants at home.
Because, as you mentioned, the Senate bill last year didn't allow homegrown, and there were some people who described that bill as being corporate weed. So
right.
Was that an important provision for the House to take up?
You know, I think that's something that they felt was an important component to include. A lot of people heard from constituents that was an important aspect for them, and so they took it to heart.
The House Judiciary Committee has been spending a fair amount of time on this bill. What do you think the outlook for it is in the committee?
So the committee this year seems like there is support at this point to get this bill out. The legislation it's sponsored by two Democrats and a Republican. These are the top, the ranking members of the committee. And importantly, notably, has the support of Representative Tom Burdett, who's a Republican from Rutland. He had voted against the bill last year. He says that he personally is not against legalization, but he heard very strongly from constituents that they were very much against it, so he voted in line with them. This year, he came back and he said, you know, I feel like this is going to happen. I feel like we're on this path, and the most powerful position that he could be in would be supporting it so that he could have a say in how it shakes out. So he is one of the key members who switched on this. Then it's also just a very different makeup than last year. We have a lot more several representatives who are just more inclined to support it. And there are some people who are still on the fence but are considering it. And their support sort of relies on certain other factors that might go along with this. One important thing is traffic safety.
As we speak, the committee is looking at the possibility of reducing the amount that a person can legally possess from 2 ounces down to 1 ounce. What's driving that debate?
So initially the bill included would have allowed adults to have up to 2 ounces of marijuana on them without a penalty. A lot of people felt that that was too much. There was some discussion about, you know, that could equal about 60 joints, which a lot of people says is too much to have around. And so they're looking at taking this, reducing it down to 1 ounce for no penalty. Then there would be a civil penalty for between 1 and 2 ounces. And then above that, up to a pound would be a misdemeanor offense. These are all they're lesser offenses than under current law. Again, this is a proposal at this point. They haven't finalized the bill, but it does look like they're leaning towards this lesser amount.
Governor Scott said this week that he would not support a marijuana legalization bill unless it contains some strong driver impairment provisions. Can a bill address those? I mean, right now, for people who are driving impaired with alcohol, we have the breathalyzer test, but is there a comparable test for marijuana?
Well, not at this point. There are some changing technologies that are leaning in that direction. One of those is a saliva tester, and there's a bill that's currently in House Transportation that would explore using that technology. It's pretty controversial technology at this point. It's pretty new. There's some question about its accuracy, and then there are also privacy concerns around it that some advocates have raised, and there's a lot of resistance at this point to that kind of technology. The House Transportation Committee is also looking at a different bill that would consider establishing limits for THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana that affects impairment. This bill would propose to lower the legal limit for alcohol to 0.05 for those who have THC in their system, which is a nod to that sign that data tends to show that there's a higher risk of accident when you have both substances in your system than if you just have one. There are some concerns around that as well. Many say that having THC in your system is not a clear indicator of impairment, and so there's some resistance there. It's still up in the air what that committee is going to do with these bills. I spoke with the chair, Representative Pat Brennan, earlier today, and he said that they're expecting to have a bill come through from the Agency of Transportation that sort of tackles safety on roads in general, that they're going to be looking at these drugged driving safety measures as a part of that. And he's expecting to move forward with that in March.
Because I had talked to Representative Chip Conquest, who's one of the sponsors of the legalization bill, and he said he supports efforts for drug impairment provisions, but he doesn't want it tied up with the legalization bill.
Right. And the chair of House Judiciary, Representative Maxine Grad, has echoed that sentiment that she believes that it's House Judiciary's job to look at judiciary issues, and that these are significant issues, but they belong in a different committee and are under a different jurisdiction. And so anything that moves forward is likely to move independently of the legalization bill.
And it's one of the problems here that marijuana can stay in a person's system for days, if not weeks.
Right. It's a very different – THC is a very different substance than alcohol. It depending on your metabolism, on your body, you will hold on to it in a different way than somebody else, and that's one of the questions here, is that, you know, there really isn't a parallel to a breathalyzer that gives a clear indication of the level of somebody's impairment.
So when all is said and done, does this bill reach the House floor this session, and does it pass?
It looks like it is moving towards the floor. The committee has been doing a lot of work on this, and they seem like they are trying to move it forward with it fairly quickly. And, you know, once it gets to the floor, there is a good chance that it'll pass. So we could see what the Senate has to do with it this year.
What do you think the Senate would do with it, considering that their approach last year was that state regulatory approach, and this bill is so different?
You know, when I spoke with Senator Dick Sears, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee on this, he said that he thinks it's a good step forward. Not really clear what they're going to do with it at this point, but it will be interesting to see how that shakes out.
Well, it's certainly an issue we'll be following in the weeks ahead. Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
That's our program for today. Coming up on Monday, is our country losing faith in science? On the next Vermont Edition, we'll talk about the role of science in society and how scientists can respond to the eroding public trust. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the program today. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.